Hey everybody, welcome to Required Reading. This week we return to Hitchhiker and the sequel, which is a little bit more, I don't even know how you put it, esoteric, a little bit more non sequitur, but still a lot of fun. Now, we had a discussion on panel whether or not we should do any more of these. If the thesis of the show is to talk about movies and books of movies and movies of books, that you would have watched in school or read in school or talked about in school. Does going deeper into these series make sense? Let us know. Hit us up on our socials or email us and let us know if you think we should keep doing this. In the meantime, keep rating and reviewing us, and hopefully you'll keep at it. That's how we get our attention. That's how people find our show, is with your reviews and your comments. And as you review us more, we move up the charts on iTunes and Spotify and all that things. So, thanks everyone. Bye. Welcome to Required Reading. This week we're checking back in with Douglas Adams, and we're doing The Restaurant at the End of the Universe, the second in the poorly named Hitchhiker's trilogy. I'm your host, Nick Hoffman, and on panel we've got...
Mike Carroll.
Mike Burns.
So we are checking back in a growing, increasingly more absurdist book. Now, Mike and I were talking about this earlier. Part of this, I think, is because the original was from a radio show. If you don't know, Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy originally was a BBC radio program, and then the first book is based a lot on that. As this continues, it gets more in his own head, and that makes it more, it's absurd. It's absurdist comedy. And so by the time we get to the third one, he's really just writing the books now, and the world becomes more complex in that way.
Yeah, we were just briefly chatting about it, and it certainly... You can see that there's an attempt at adding, as disparate as it is, a plot to kind of like the madness here. And the first in the series, Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, kind of feels a lot like a stand-up comedy routine where you have kind of the jokes that are kind of the main points that are bridged to with a little bit of plot, but there's not much there in terms of any sort of plot. And so you can tell that there's definitely an attempt at adding some plot to kind of the madness and the craziness. I still loved it. I was making my way through. You might, if you tune back into our previous episode on Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, you'll hear me say before we start into our conversation that I was really nervous about that episode because it can be really difficult to talk about comedy without spoiling the joke, right? I'm sure everybody listening at home, you've got your favorite comedy movies that you're used to seeing. And sometimes if you've got friends that don't have the right cadence that totally destroy the jokes before you even get a chance to see the movie, sometimes it's kind of dead in the water. And I feel a lot of times like comedy, and especially books that are so based around comedy, can oftentimes be that way. And I was nervous going into that first podcast about Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, and I was a little bit nervous coming into this one too. But more nervous going into the reading, because I was reminded as I was making my way through it that for me at least, the jokes still landed. And I did find myself still laughing out loud at points as I was making my way through the story. I know that I don't necessarily land on the same pedestal as you guys with this second one, but I'll be curious to hear what it is that you guys liked about it and what it is that you all didn't like about it in rereading back through it.
Yeah, I'll agree. It was a slow, I think I texted you guys at one point, like, I'm not into this. This is hard. And I didn't know what I was going to say. And then somewhere around sort of chapter six, there was some jokes, some allusion to like Playbean magazine voting that planet the best place to be, and then suddenly they all commit suicide, and that made me laugh. And then just it took me a while to click into the humor again. And I will say that it still reads like a radio drama to me. It's very episodic. Like this happens, boom, then we get to another planet, or sort of almost like a Doctor Who episode. Like it's all very finite within the way, but there are little threads of sort of characters or universal questions that carry it through. So yeah, it was pleasant. but you know, it was, I don't know if it's, I think it's probably better if you read it back to back to back to back to back. Mm-hmm. So you just kind of stay in that same vein or same mindset or same world that he's created. That's my reaction. Yeah.
I mean, and I will say, as someone who's like a fan of old comedy, it feels very Monty Python-ish, right? Totally. Like, because it's absurdist, it's over the top. I know he hung out with those guys occasionally. And then, like, humor hasn't been this absurdist in a long time. Like we go through waves of it, right? Like, you know, in the early 2000s with things like Homestar Runner and that kind of thing, and a lot of Adult Swim shows, that's very absurdist. But now we've gone more, in some ways, back to linear, like, sitcom stuff, you know, the biggest shows on the planet for a while were things like Big Bang Theory or Young Sheldon, which is really a sign of our decline as a culture. But, you know, like the, you know, things like Ted Lasso are very linear. Mm-hmm. It's just weird to watch, you know, what is mainstream comedy, our flag means death, you know, that kind of stuff, Dark Shadow or whatever. And then swing back to this, which is so absurdist, you know, to me it's kind of a palate cleanser, but I understand where Mike's coming from, where Burns is coming from here. It does feel very disparate, very weird. It's hard to get into the pace of this book unless you go from one to the next to the next to the next.
So the question, and I'll follow up, because today at school was like a dress like your character day or whatever, mm-hmm. and so Mike, you dressed like Arthur.
Yeah.
But I'm wondering, to your point, Nick, does this hold up to today's times? Like, would people – nobody recognized you,
yep.
and that was where I was heading. So do people read Douglas Adams anymore, and or should they?
I mean, I think that first book I read here – I read for summer reading at one point, I think.
Right. So that's 20 years ago at least, right?
I mean, clearly.
Probably. It's like ninth grade summer list.
Ago, yeah, almost 25. So, I mean, in that way, I would say it is interestingly structured. First of all, it's linear, so no kid would recognize it. But second, there is something to be said about, I don't know, maybe just as a genre. I like it as, like, comedy as a genre. I don't know how much the kids actually read. I think we absorb comedy more visually, auditorially. So I think something that is read, it's just genre-breaking for them. But I hope they still read it. As far as going into the deeper into the series, I don't know how many do. I imagine if you asked, most like people who read it read the first one, and I don't know how many read past that.
Yeah, I think it's interesting, Nick, that you said that you read it as almost like tangentially. It certainly wasn't taught in your class, but you read it kind of like tangentially in school. In other words, that through this summer reading list, if nowhere else, you had a teacher essentially that kind of like slid it across the desk for you, that yeah. that it was listed as one of the possible summer readings, and you picked it up and you liked it enough to read the rest of the series. I know that I kind of came to it, or rather my brother came to it in a really similar way. I think that over the course of his, I believe it was his either freshman or sophomore year of high school, they had an opportunity for like an extra credit where you would just read through like any one of the books that was on this list and either do a report on it or write a paper about it or something like that. And my brother read the first in the book series, Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, and I remember him being in a Fuddruckers of all places, and he was reading through Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
Is it at the end of the universe?
So there's a, might be, right? But he was, gosh, if the Fuddruckers was the restaurant at the end of the universe, it's a clever thought. But anyways, neither here nor there, my brother was reading in the booth, and he was laughing out loud as he was reading it. And my brother was somebody, especially like kind of in those early high school years, that and I don't think that he would be offended if I said this, he wasn't as much of a reader. I certainly, later on in the season, we'll get into the Redwall books, and I loved the Redwall books. I was reading them all the time when I was younger. But my brother didn't really read books for pleasure all that much, and yet he had this book that was essentially, through way of this extra credit assignment, slid across his desk, and then he read all of them. And so he, knowing that I was an avid reader, handed it to me, and so I read the first one. And I know this is kind of like bad podcasting here, that I'm talking about like the actual version of the book, but you can tell that the version of the restaurant at the end of the universe that I have is absolutely beaten up, and you can see that like the ribbing on the side.
Well loved, I would say.
Well, the reason for that is because it spent the summer in my pool bag, coming back and forth from Cedardale Aquatics, because I did read it the series through. I remember I read the first one. Once my brother handed it to me, it must have been my eighth grade or like ninth grade year. My brother handed me the first one, and I loved Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. Then later on in the summer, I read The Restaurant at the End of the Universe. And later on in the summer, we were flying down to Florida, and I can remember reading the next in the series, Life, the Universe, and Everything, which is the next book that's in the five-part series. I was reading it on the airplane on the way down to Florida. So we're talking a lot about like picking up the series and just making your way through it, and that being a way that you might really enjoy it. That's exactly how I encountered it. So I wonder if that might play a bit of a role into my kind of like special place that I have in my heart for the series.
There you go.
And it's interesting, I wonder too, and maybe we talked about this before, I honestly don't remember, but we all encountered this as teenage boys.
Like, yeah.
Do women read this? And then two, it's kind of shocking that nobody recognized you, Mike, like
yeah.
even someone of your age group or my age group even, so it's older. I mean, the book's predates me in high school even.
Yeah, well, a couple of things on that note. One, it was 85 degrees today, so about halfway through the day, I lost the rope. And I feel like that's probably one of the most glaring indications that—
I think that's within character, though. I think you're still in character.
But still, nevertheless, a couple of years ago, I came as Arthur Dent as well, and it was
did you?
Only—
I don't remember.
There was the worker who was in the cafeteria who kind of like was serving me my chicken parm sandwich or whatever it happened to be, and said, "Oh, Arthur Dent, that's awesome, great costume." And it is admittedly a really lazy— it's a great costume if you want to be able to be very comfortable all day in a robe and slippers. I mean, I'm still wearing the slippers right now, but I don't think that it's as recognizable to that point. I think that it's something— I mean, the book came out a while ago, and I mean the movie came out at this point probably close to
'05, I think.
At this point we're coming up on 20 years ago that the movie came out, and the movie wasn't even all that much of a success either, so it ends up being, I think, something that's kind of certainly falling out of the zeitgeist. I will say, on your note about do women or female readers, are they drawn to it? I was saying to Catherine, we were on the couch a couple of nights ago, and I was saying how excited I was to get into the podcast and talk about Restaurant at the End of the Universe. And I was asking her whether she read, whether she made it much farther than Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, whether she ended up continuing along the series, how far she had gotten. And she looked at me and she said, "Mike, I read Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy because I loved you." And she did not make it any further than Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. So I don't know. I'm sure that Catherine would not want to be speaking on behalf of all female readers everywhere. But I do wonder if there's something to— If there is something to encountering it, myself, you, Mike, Nick, even my brother, all young teenage boys who find a way into this absurd, humorous story, and it's just something that kind of anchors in.
I mean, I figure it's also kind of a set, right? Like, I think, how do you recommend this to someone? Do you like Monty Python? I think those people would probably like it.
Yeah.
You said Doctor Who. I think he actually wrote a few Doctor Who episodes.
Right.
That feels very Doctor Who-y. I would say that's there too. And again, we can get into it a little bit. We can't just— this isn't just a comedy bit, but I believe the first line, and I don't have it in front of me, I'm running the ones and twos, but at the beginning it says something along the lines of, the story so far: in the beginning the universe was created. This made a lot of people very angry and has been widely regarded as a bad move. That's it. If you find that funny, you're
right.
In. If you don't, the humor doesn't become any more optimistic throughout the rest of this. There's this kind of, A, it's absurdist, but it's also very, what'd you say, nihilistic. It's not mean. It's just, it's cynical.
Yeah.
Perhaps.
But yeah. It's so clever and it's so funny.
It is.
And I think that it thrives, at least for me, off of those vignettes. I don't think that it thrives because of the plot, certainly not. I think that it thrives because of the vignettes. And I think that Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy thrives in that same way, in those memorable moments of the missiles being shot at the Heart of Gold. This is from the first episode, or the podcast episode of the book, first book. The missiles being fired at the Heart of Gold, turning into a petunia plant and a whale that are plummeting down. Right. Those are the things that— those snippets, those scenes, those that are totally made for radio. Those are the things that I think really thrive in I think that it's what thrives in Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. I think it's what thrives in The Restaurant at the End of the Universe. I mean, there's a couple that we'll get into that, I mean, once again, I found myself laughing out loud because I just find the writing so clever and the vignettes so memorable, and it's so crazy that it just, for me, it just works. And I think that if you're in this for kind of the linear plot, you're going to be disappointed. If you're in this for kind of like your traditional comedy, you're going to be disappointed. If you're in this because you saw Monty Python and the Holy Grail, now we might be getting somewhere, because I feel like in a similar way, you get the snippets, you get those vignettes, you get those kind of episodes that are just so gosh darn funny. And it's, I think that there's a reason why, right when I was reading this, when I was in eighth, ninth grade, probably would have said that Monty Python and the Holy Grail was my favorite comedy movie. And wow. And I think that there's just something about the structure that's so witty and so clever that it just works.
And just to talk about the structure of this book, because it is very funny, and I enjoyed it. I guess we're ranking how much we enjoyed it. I enjoyed it the second most. But you have the plot as it is. But it's cut up with sections of The Hitchhiker's Guide itself, which to me are often the funniest bits. Mm-hmm. Like there's a section pretty early on where it's describing how big the universe is. And it's saying, the universe is incredibly vast. Imagine the biggest thing you can think of, and it's infinitely bigger than that too. And it, you know, it's essentially Wikipedia. The Hitchhiker's Guide is essentially a curated Wikipedia. Mm-hmm. That's something that Wikipedia took advantage of early on. But it describes the population of the universe as zero. And it says, the definition is, it is known that there is an infinite number of worlds, simply because there's an infinite amount of space for them to be in. However, not every one of them is inhabited. Therefore, there must be a finite number of inhabited worlds. Any finite number divided by infinity is as near to nothing as to make the odds. So the average population of all planets in the universe can be said to be zero. From this, it follows that the population of the whole universe is also zero, and that any people you may meet from time to time are merely the products of a deranged imagination. Again, I find that incredibly well written. It's very funny. It's sarcastic. But it's also the cynical view of the book, and that's what repeats throughout. And again, I understand. If this is not your humor, this is going to be a very long book for you. And it's, what, 200 pages? It's a quick read. It's a good quick read.
Yeah, barely. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I can kind of attempt to bring us through. I keep talking about how the plot aspects of this story are the parts that I like the least, but I do think that we owe it to ourselves to at least kind of like march our way a little bit through the plot. So it does pick up right where Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy leaves off, almost as much as to the point that you could start reading The Restaurant at the End of the Universe, chapter one, and it almost reads as what would end up being chapter 27 or whatever it is at the end of Hitchhikers. But it starts with there's a ship of Vogons who have been hired by a group of psychiatrists who don't want to lose their job by virtue of the fact that potentially Zaphod Beeblebrox and his gang of misfits could potentially figure out the answer to the life, the universe, and everything. Rather, the question to the life, the universe, and everything, because the answer is 42. And so they're right there. You're thrown into the absurdity, or you're reminded of the absurdity of the previous book. But these Vogons are firing on the Heart of Gold, which is the name of the ship that is powered by an improbability drive, to the point that they are in a desperation move to try and get out of the path of these missiles, to which Zaphod Beeblebrox ends up calling upon his great-great-grandfather, Zaphod Beeblebrox IV, which I know what you're thinking, wouldn't that be the original Zaphod Beeblebrox, but there was I can't remember the line exactly, but there was a consummation mistake made in a time machine or something along those lines. And so things were done in reverse, and so Zaphod Beeblebrox is there talking to his great-great-grandfather, who apparently is younger than him. Anyways, the Zaphod Beeblebrox IV ends up sending the crew, or so he thinks, off to figure out the question. Oh, no. He wants him to go and find the ruler of the universe and basically give him a hard time for not doing things better. And so in order to do this, Zaphod Beeblebrox does save the day in terms of these missiles that are making their way towards the ship, but ends up teleporting not all of the crew, but only Zaphod and Marvin to the planet that is the home of the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. So transports them to the Mega Dodo Publishing planet, which is where the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy is made, so that Zaphod can then follow this amnesia thread that he has in his mind, that he needs to go there and talk to somebody named Zarniwoop, who is going to somehow lead him to the ruler of the universe so we can give him a hard time about the way in which he created the universe. So right there, you're thrown into this absurdity. But I do want to talk a little bit about that moment where Zaphod Beeblebrox the Fourth ends up dispersing this crew, because you also have Arthur Dent, you also have Ford Prefect, and you've got Trillian, who, and you've got Marvin and Zaphod, obviously. But this is kind of like, if you can imagine, in the Lord of the Rings series, you get kind of like the dispersal of the Fellowship, right? In that moment where now all of a sudden our different characters are going off to different planets, and it's part of what allows, structurally, it's part of what allows Douglas Adams to expand his universe, no pun intended. He's now expanding the different lenses through which we can take in this interesting universe that he's that he's taking us through, right? So we just multiplied by two the number of planets that we can go and visit by dispersing our group of misfits that we have. So I think that that's another kind of thing that I like in literature, is that we're expanding our glimpse into this crazy world that Douglas Adams is creating through the plot of Zaphod Beeblebrox the Fourth kind of dispersing our shipmates, if that makes sense.
Now, as far as the actual structure of what's going on here, we should mention, too, Arthur is blissfully aware of life as we know it at this point. He essentially destroys the ship and the computer by asking for a cup of tea, because mm-hmm. they keep giving him this... I mean, it just sounds like that terrible food product, Soylent. Like, this is a nutritious sludge that's... Mm-hmm. It tastes awful. And the computer, which is supposed to be able to make everything that he asks for, is unable to accomplish this. Although I guess the funny thing is the company that makes it, which I'm not going to get right here, is so bad at what they do. They have an entire planet of essentially tech support, and the planet filled with the support people grew so large that it's taken over the nearby system and crushed itself under the sign that was the, you know, the 1-800 number.
Yeah, exactly.
Essentially. But he describes what tea is, the history of, like, the Indian Raj, like, all this East India Company, and it shuts down the computers right as the Vogons have launched their missiles.
Yeah.
So they're essentially killed by the... The previous book ends by saying we could just build an automaton that asks for tea all the time. Well, he asks for tea and nearly kills them all.
Right.
Right, which is great.
But he gets his tea.
He gets his tea.
And it's delicious.
It's pretty nice.
Yeah. In a moment that only I feel like Douglas Adams could create.
Right.
But it then goes into, so kind of like following along with the plot. So now we have kind of like our inciting moment. We have now Zaphod, who's on his way to give the ruler of the universe a hard time and ask the ruler of the universe a couple of questions about why it is that he did things the way that he did. So they're on this planet.
Well, we should mention here, too, Zaphod is still not sure why he did what he did, right? Mm-hmm. And in his own brain, there's part of it that has been separated, presumably by himself, yeah. which we'll find out. And so he's trying to figure out what's going on in his own head, because if you've forgotten, Zaphod has two brains and mm-hmm. two heads, and they are disconnected. And I assume this is also the Knights Who Say Knee, like just weird words in English,
yeah.
right?
Mm-hmm.
And we have Zarniwoop and Zaphod and Vogon, and these are just collections.
Yeah.
We're about to end up with Gravarar.
Yeah. I mean, the names are like, in some ways, as specific and as guttural as like a Dickens character and a Dickens name, and at the same time, like as creative and zany as like a Douglas Adams character. It's his names really are something.
Yeah.
So they make their way to this planet where they're on the like in the building in which the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy is being published, and need to take an elevator up to Zarni Whoop's office. And the elevator doesn't want to go up. And this was one of the first moments that I remembered the vignette and I found myself laughing because you have an elevator that is saying to Zaphard, like, oh, can I speak with you about a nice unassuming down rather than going up? And you get an elevator that's afraid of heights, that's a clever kind of like Douglas Adams-ism, if you will. And then the Frog Star fighters are there to kind of like destroy this planet, and end up teleporting the building, through which Zaphod and Marvin do indeed survive. But they're brought to on this Frog Star fighters world B that this building and that these characters end up getting transported to, they get like arrested, I guess is the best way to describe it, and brought to, for punishment, the Total Perspective Vortex, which is another one of the moments that I had remembered, which is this kind of like torture device that's supposed to show a being just how small they are in the universe, and that's supposed to be like torture enough for the person to just like collapse into a puddle of their own insignificantness, I guess you could say. And so this whole creation of this machine was based off of like a piece of cake, and as a result of either somebody coming in like eating the cake or through some series of fortunate events for Zaphod, he of course sees himself as being like the most important thing in the entire universe. So the machine doesn't work on him. He's able to survive this kind of torture device, which ends up with him continuing along in his search for Zarni Whoop. He ends up finding a ship that was supposed to be going on like a luxury cruise that is stuck at bay because they don't have the right kind of napkins. And it's at this point that Zarni Whoop discover Zarni Whoop. Zaphod and Zarni Whoop encounter one another. We see that it's all a big simulation and that the Heart of Gold has been in Zaphod Beeblebrox's pocket the entire time. They enlarge in the Heart of Gold once again and reunite Zaphod and Marvin with his crew so that they can finally go to the restaurant at the end of the universe. And so that's like the next 50 pages or so of vignettes and craziness that is the plot. But then we're finally all back together, and it turns out that Arthur indeed got his tea.
That's good. Do you need a minute?
No.
I will say the funny thing that, again, that I think Douglas Adams was very clever about, is what happens to Frogstar B, why it is the way it is, was because their economy collapsed because of what they called the shoe event horizon.
Yeah. Yeah.
The idea that they reached essentially the peak society and they built so many shoe stores that the economy collapsed under the weight of the shoe stores, which again, it's... I'm sure we're close with what, the tulip crisis in the Netherlands or... Mm-hmm. Just Toms in general destroying economies, yeah, because they were given out for free. But I love that is such a cynical British, like, it's beautiful. I do like that. But anyway, Mike, did you have any thoughts, Mr. Burns?
I got nothing. I mean, just, yeah, this plot and there's, yeah, all the little observational little bits along the way. Yeah, I have nothing to add. I'm sorry.
No, you're fine. Because like this is where, I don't want to say the book breaks down for me. This is where I find it, the jokes are funny, the plot makes no sense,
yeah, mm-hmm,
right? Because like we have this whole discussion with Gravigrov, whatever that guy's name, mm-hmm, is, and he's having like
the disembodied voice, yeah.
Yeah, his body is having a trial separation with his consciousness,
yeah,
which... I want to assume this is, again, like a Doctor Who thing. This is a joke, a reference that I just don't get. And when it comes up, it's very strange.
Yeah. A little bit off-putting, I would say.
But the horror element here is the suspended animation. Yeah. So there's a plane that's been there for 900 years. The passengers are all on board, but it's supposed to be like an interstellar ship. So in between, the people are essentially put into some sort of hypersleep. Mm-hmm. And so because they've been waiting for 900 years, they wake up to terrifying consciousness for a few minutes at a time to get fresh coffee.
Yep.
And then they're knocked back out again now for 900 years before Zarni Whoop shows up. And, like, we advance the plot. But, again, this is a very Doctor Who, woo-wee-woo, nonsense kind of, like, scary sci-fi moment. But Zaphod is walking through the stair as a robot stewardess is telling him to sit down.
Yeah.
Which is, it's a lot. It's a lot. Mm-hmm. But yeah, this idea that you have what evidence of your society is going to be left behind. This is very Cold War mentality. This is the 1980s, so we're about to have another big nuclear scare under Reagan. The idea that you would be what's left behind is semi-conscious people on an airplane waiting.
Yeah.
Politely queuing up is very British to me. Mm-hmm. I like that. Anyway, you can go ahead, man. I just...
Yeah. No.
There's so many weird little nuggets in this story.
It's almost like Douglas Adams, like, writes himself into a corner and then ends up being like, oh, but he had the heart of gold in his pocket all along. So then he... And there are some points in it that if you... Again, I mean, I think we started this by saying if you're following this along for the plot, I think you're going to end up being disappointed. But if you kind of accept that for what it is and suspend your disbelief, not with the science fiction elements that are part of this story that are everywhere, but if you kind of suspend your disbelief with the plot being kind of like a conventional plot, then you might kind of enjoy some of those kind of vignettes and some of those moments along the way. So I think we're coming up to another one that I really like, and maybe it's because I someday have, if I were to ever like hit the lottery and have like a full money at my disposal to be able to do anything that I would want, opening up a Milliways, which is the restaurant at the end of the universe that has like all of these different drinks, including but not limited to Pan Galactic Gargle Blaster, which is yet another throwback to Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. There are a couple of moments, and I'll talk once I get through the plot about some of those callbacks and why I think that some hit for me and why it is that I think that some don't. But they make their way. They say that Zaphod tells the Heart of Gold that he wants to go to the nearest restaurant, and so the computer says, "Got it," and fast forwards them from the very spun. It takes a little bit before we realize this as the reader, but it transports them from the very spot that they are into the future, into a restaurant that is nearly in that exact location in outer space, but it's very far into the future. And it's in kind of like a time bubble that allows for this restaurant to exist at the end of the universe. Now, we're not talking the end of the universe in terms of like geologically or geographically. We're not like on the edge, like the cliff edge or the end of the universe. It means in terms of the time of the end of the universe. So every night as as kind of like a replay, because they have the time going in reverse at the restaurant at the end of the universe, they have like a performance, if you will, like a show that is the universe ending in this little time bubble in this restaurant at the end of the universe. Well, that happens to be the closest restaurant to in the far into the future when where it is that our characters happen to be at the time. And so we get to encounter this very crazy world. It's almost like, I can't remember the name of it, but in like Star Wars, the name of the bar that's always frequented, and you have the music and the everybody's like playing the same card game and everything. It's just kind of like this eclectic group of people from all over the universe, from all over the galaxy. And I'm really drawn to Milliways and that restaurant that's there. A couple of the things that are happening there, you get a very drunken conversation about how time, like how the Big Bang starts. And it's basically like take a whole bunch of glitter, put it into a bathtub and let it go down the drain. But because it's a drunken way of explaining this, he's like, oh, wait, but you have to video record that and then put it in reverse. And that's like the creation of the universe. And just that like has stuck with me, this vision of like in reverse glitter coming back up into the bathtub. It's like a really clever and drunken but ingenious way of explaining like the creation of time through this like reverse spiral of a bathtub. And every time as like I'm hitting the water in the drain as I'm putting like as I'm doing a bath for my daughter, like I'm reminded of the way that it's described at Milliway. So that's a cool little tidbit there. I love the cow that has been genetically designed to want people to eat parts of its body. So at Milliway, the the servers or the cows like literally come up to the table and explain like,
would you like to meet your meat? Yes.
Would you like to meet your meat? Exactly. And of course, Arthur is so put off by this that he orders like a salad and a soup or something like that at the restaurant at the end of the universe. But the cow is the one that's trying to convince the diners to eat the particular shanks that are on his body. And there's a musical performance by the band Disaster Area, which is a great name. And as the
we're not performing at the restaurant,
but the ship is parked outside of the restaurant because Marvin has been there for like millions of years valeting cars at the restaurant at the end of the universe because it was so close to the location that Zaphod had reignited, if you will, the Heart of Gold. So things get crazy at Milliways, and maybe they should put that on the Milliways t-shirt.
I gotta back up though, Mike. I'm surprised you didn't talk about chapter 15 with like the little nuggets and diversions where he goes in about the different verb tenses.
Oh, I love that. You're right, Mike.
I thought this was written for Mike Carroll here.
Yeah, if you've got the part, you can.
Well, he's talking about like how do you talk about the future that's going to happen that hasn't happened yet if you're going to travel back in time, and just sort of plays around with the illogic of time traveling and how do you describe that grammatically. And so there's a handbook of 1,001 tense formations, but eventually get to the punchline, or one of the punchlines is that they decided to get rid of the future perfect because
It wasn't, oh, I loved
since
that.
It does, it discovered not to be. And so just like there's a page of that sort of discursive fun, essentially, especially if you're an English teacher a couple of us are.
Yeah. So. I mean, and to wit, the reason we get the concert is because a very, very drunk Ford prefect recognized Hot Black Desiato, who is legally dead. And so he's trying to have this conversation, and he keeps mixing up his verb tenses because he realizes his friend is temporarily dead for legal reasons or whatever it was.
For tax reasons. Tax reasons, that's right.
And so they're watching all this stuff. Which allows us to have Zaphod said, I've seen the end of the universe, it's all about me, and that's why we can leave.
Yeah. And they're reminded, they get a phone call from Marvin, who's valeting cars out in the parking lot. And so they go back out to, or not cars, I guess it would be like spaceships. And I can't remember if Disaster Area was playing in the restaurant or not. It's such a crazy plot that I can't keep it straight. But the ship that is this beautiful, sleek, black ship that Zaphod sees and immediately
needs to steal it.
Yeah, exactly. And so not knowing this, however, the ship every night, I guess, ends up being flown into like a sun in order to create all these flares for the spectacle at the restaurant at the end of the universe. And it's at that point that Arthur... So they all get on board this ship that they are stealing, but the ship is on autopilot making its way in towards the sun, and somebody needs to stay behind on the ship, and you get kind of like a begrudging, if you will, sacrificial moment by Marvin, our manically depressed robot, who stays behind and lets the and kind of, so to speak, goes down with the ship as it goes into the sun and creates all these flares. But then we have another moment where we have our characters that are split from one another. So once again, it gives us the opportunity to kind of re-examine this crazy universe now through Zaphod and Trillian and Zarniwoop, who are going to find the ruler of the universe and his cat, along, and then Ford and Arthur, who... I'll just kind of skip ahead a little bit here, who end up going to a prehistoric Earth. And the way that they realize that, I found pretty funny too, with the callback to the fjords and the creator of Earth from the first, who has his like face and his signature in the glaciers of Earth. So we get another split where we get our characters on prehistoric Earth with some developed characters, some that are still kind of like Neanderthals, and then we get the characters who are off to the planet on which the ruler of the universe lives, who's a man in a shack with his cat.
A man who immediately forgets everything once it happens. Mm-hmm. So essentially we get a very cynical view of government where like the president of the universe must not matter. There must be someone behind all the madness, right? Mm-hmm. And it's... this old stoner. I don't know how, like...
Yeah.
he forgets everything the second they show up. And, you know, Zaphod's like, well, whatever he's doing, it seems to be working. I'm the president.
Like, yeah.
Well, yeah, he makes some nice political comments there. Like, the people who most want to rule the universe are going to be awful at it because it's all about them versus the people that are competent and interested. And so, like, yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
And it's one of those little moments, like, observational humor that he inserts into these bizarre situations that hold up nicely.
And Zarni Whoop is not happy with the ruler of the universe's answers. And Zaphod and Trillian are just like, well, I guess that it's almost like one of those things where we are more in the spot of Trillian and Zaphod, I feel like, when we've been following along these stories and their absurdity for all of these chapters, and we're kind of defeated, right, like Zaphod and Trillian are, but the just the image of the ruler of the universe kind of like in their own shack, in his own shack, kind of like petting his cat and trying to feed it tuna. And the cat doesn't even want anything to do with the ruler of the universe. Yeah. And the ruler of the universe isn't even convinced that, like, anything exists outside of that shack either. It's like, how can we know that there are other planets? As soon as you shut that door, doesn't that create, like, destroy, or not destroy, but how can we know that the rest of the universe exists outside of our realm of observation? It's kind of like if a tree falls in the forest and nobody's around to hear it, does it actually make a sound? And Zarni Whoop is not happy with this, and Zaphod and Trillian are kind of like putting their hands up in not even defeat, but just like in acceptance of the craziness that is this story in this universe.
As you're saying that, I'm thinking, why can't this be a religion? Why is Scientology catch on? Why can't just like chill and just go with the flow and don't panic and like
very deist,
adopt that? Right? Yeah, exactly.
Just like, there,
whatever.
Just, whatever. His cat.
But as you're saying that too, I think like that's the type of you have to adopt that as a reader, right? Because you don't know what the hell's going to happen when you turn the page. But you're just like, okay, I'm going to go with it and just go along for the ride.
It's a book that acknowledges that its own narrator has no idea what's happening, right?
Yeah.
I have the quote. The major problem, one of the major problems, for there are several, one of the many major problems with governing people is that who you get to do it, rather, who manages to get to people to let them do it to them. To summarize, it is a well-known fact that people who must want to rule people are, ipso facto, the least suited to do it.
Yeah.
To summarize the summary, anyone who is capable of getting themselves made president should, on no account, be allowed to do the job. There you go.
Yeah, cue current events.
Yeah. Exactly.
Exactly. It's the way he words those things is so funny, and I do love that. And then again, Zartobartfast re-enters the room, and he's like, where were those people who were just here? Where's Trillian? Where's Zaphod? He goes, I don't know who you're talking about. Because once – he's like – he's got no object permanence. Yeah. Once he's left the site, he doesn't know if they exist anymore.
And it's almost like an annoying philosophy professor is like, well, I don't know. Where are they?
Right,
It's
a Buddhist cone,
yeah,
right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's Bertrand Russell. Like the joke from Mitchell and Webb book is like, I spent the afternoon trying to prove that my chair existed so I could sit in it. Right? Like it's like at a certain point – everything doesn't matter. The other side, the thing that ends us, is now Ford and Arthur are on a planet. First they end up on an ARC ship, which is filled with hairdressers and like public relations consultants and graphic designers.
Telephone disinfectors, right?
And a captain who refuses to get out of the tub.
Yep.
And a first officer who's like... he reminds me of the guy from Animal House, right? Like the guy in charge of the frat who's like
a little toady.
Yeah. And they are supposed to crash land on this planet, which you already told us is Earth, 2 million years ago.
Mm-hmm. Where they're met with kind of like two different groups of people, the Neanderthals and then the Golgafinchians. I have that written down.
Golgafinchians.
Which is the kind of like the slightly more developed in a conventional sense, certainly more developed. But the Golgafinchians have like a financial crisis because they create a financial system based off of leaves, which are in abundance until the value of the leaf drops down significantly. And there were some funny lines with that. But with the Neanderthals, this kind of brings us in through to the end. We're met with Arthur trying to like teach these Neanderthals English and trying to kind of like teach them basic math and things as simple as like the convention of the wheel and fire and trying to kind of like help bolster what Arthur believes to be the future of humanity. And the Neanderthals end up they end up kind of, oh no, it's Arthur who ends up like spelling out. It says that he was feeling a certain way. So he had IT, and then he like found in the Scrabble, like without even thinking about it, an S and an H and put them before it. So we get kind of like what it is that Arthur is feeling. He's feeling like shit. And kind of like he's reminded of the fact that he, in his brainwaves, he was reminded by Marvin, holds the question to the answer that of the universe, which is 42. So they start kind of like putting their hands into the bag one at a time, and Arthur starts laying it out, and they start to assemble the question that hopefully is will lead to the answer of the life, the universe, and everything. And then it's, what do you get if you multiply 6? And then everybody would think that it would be 7, but it's 6 and 9. And so it's just adds on to that absurdity. Arthur and Ford are frustrated by this. At one point, there is a funny line towards the end where Ford, in his frustration, takes the letter Q and throws it into the river, at which point a fox ends up, or later on, he starts to like have like a bit of a fling with one of the women on this pre kind of civilized Earth, and only to the point that she ends up dying because that same letter Q that he threw into the river, a fox had choked on it, died in the river, and polluted the river, and so the girl ended up dying later on. So it's just absolutely crazy. But we get kind of like the end of the story, which is Ford and Arthur going on kind of like a double date with these girls, and they ask Arthur what it is that he has, and it's the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, which he kind of succumbs to throwing into the river in its uselessness at the end of the
story. And all along they're trying to make contact. They're trying to find a passing ship or someone that they can get the hell out of there, and they don't. Yeah, so.
I will only add one joke, which I thought was funny, that the Golgafingians are unaware as to, well, did anyone else leave with you? You're supposed to be an ark ship. Didn't everyone else come? He goes, they're not sure exactly why they had to leave, but they're supposed to leave. And then we smash cut back. They're like, and their entire species was killed off by a virus spread by dirty telephones.
Right.
Yeah. Right? Because they took all the telephone.
They were trying to get rid of the dumb people, essentially. Right, yeah, exactly. And then that's what killed them. Yeah.
And those dumb people, of course, found our planet.
Yes.
Right? Which is the joke.
Look at us today. Yeah.
Yeah. That's kind of it.
Yeah. I mean, there are certainly, just in kind of like recapping it, there are moments that work. There are moments that I think for me kind of end up falling a little bit. Like, and I'm not necessarily surprised by it. It's got a lot of the tropes of different like movies and TV shows and things that I like the notion of that amnesia. I'm reminded of Bourne with Zaphon, and kind of like piecing together things as you're going along. The notion of like the good guys being on the run with The Fugitive and U.S. Marshals, season 2 of Prison Break, like all these shows and all these movies and things that I love that are kind of like kind of wrapped up in some of these tropes that Douglas Adams is playing off of. And then there are some callbacks that I don't think work, and then some that for me do. Like, they keep calling back to the bypass from like the way that the Earth was originally destroyed. And it's one of those things where I just feel like we're listening to like a band that just has to play the hits at a concert when they're kind of like old and worn, and or even the jokes that are surrounding the number 42 or like the Vogons. But then there are some callbacks for me that totally work, like the Pangalactic Gargle Blaster, that like little subtle drink that ends up coming back. Or I was laughing so hard when the creator behind Earth, when his signature and his face was found in, because you kind of get the impression that you're on a prehistoric Earth, and then you get like the face and that callback that's right there in the glacier, and I just found that so clever, and that for me worked so well. So like some of the callbacks end up working while others don't. And so I can see why, Mike, and to a certain extent Nick, I can see why you guys might have thought that this one fell a little bit short, because it does kind of strike me as a sequel that if it's relying too heavily on the jokes of the former, and I can definitely see kind of where it is that it might fall short, because even for me who loved it, I think that I can even admit that there are some moments that fall short too.
It's not a book that you could read on its own, though. Would we agree on that? You couldn't pick it up at number two in the series, and because of all those callbacks, or you would be a little more confused than you already are, I think.
Yeah,
It's not bad at all. I mean, I was slow to get into it, and I laughed out loud at points and remembered some fun stuff. Yeah. I don't dislike it, but I think you're right. It's definitely lesser than its first one.
I mean, I enjoyed it. I thought it was funny. I don't know if you could teach it unless you had the first one first and make it an option for the second one.
Right.
But like, I find it funny. I like his use of language. I think you could structure out some of his, you know, some of those like Hitchhiker's chapters that are separate and just to show how to do this. It's kind of a masterclass in writing humor, which is hard, right?
Yeah.
Like. A lot of humor is in the timing. How do you write something to have timing? Well, he does a good job.
Yeah.
But yeah, so thanks for joining us for this. Next week, we're going to do something short in honor of the fall harvest. We're going to do of Mice and Men, which back to bleak. We are back to bleak. But yeah, stay tuned. And thank you for doing what you do to share us, keep us around, keep us on the charts. And back in December, we will be returning to Return of the King to finish that series, once again without Mike Burns, but that is fine. So keep sharing us, keep reviewing us, and keep posting on social media to make sure that we hear from you. We appreciate it.
Well, we didn't even get to adverbs. I want to talk about adverbs.
Oh, I know. Well, next episode, we'll have a little blurb about adverbs. Yeah.
All right.
So you want to plug your writing, then, Mike?
No, yeah. So I just want to say thank you to everybody who's been so supportive on social media of my writing. I had an exciting manuscript request for Beyond the Fall of Kings, which is the novel that I wrote that's historical fiction with the wars that are at the background of Beowulf, which is, for those of you that have been following around for a couple of seasons here, you guys know that it's something that's a passion piece of mine. And I love Beowulf, and the book that I wrote had a full manuscript request from an agency up in New York. So thank you for everybody for being so supportive. I've got a couple of short stories that are going to be coming out in the next couple of months with a couple of different literary magazines as well. So if you're interested in any of that, follow along michael.c.carroll for all things Required Reading Podcast, and also to stay tuned for any of those writing pieces if you're interested in them as well.
And we are recording this in October of 2023. So if you're listening to this at any other time, this might be very out of date. So follow his
future
social media.
Future perfect tense? Yeah. No.
Burns, man, we almost got out without him talking about Beowulf.
Oh, he brought it up.
Not
early.
Today.
Thanks,
not
everyone.
Today.
Bye.
See ya.
Required Reading is a product of Maris Podcasting and Dude Letter Podcasting. It is hosted by Nick Hoffman and co-hosted by Mike Burns and Mike Carroll. It is edited and produced by Nick Hoffman. The theme is Sands by Davis Burns. The opinions expressed are opinions of the hosts and the guests, but not of Marist School. All rights reserved. Thanks.